Well, this is an exciting time of year for scientists to see who gets the Nobel Prize, as the physics prize was announced yesterday and the chemistry prize was announced today, and both of them are relevant to what we talk about in the class. So the Nobel Prize in physics went to Andrei Geim and Konstantin Novoselov, who are at Manchester University. And you can see it's for groundbreaking experiments regarding the two-dimensional material graphene. Does anybody know what graphene is? Graphene, anyone? Yeah. Luke? With what? I'm sorry that I can't hear you. Yeah, it's graphite. It's what is in your pencil, except it's a layer of it. You know, and graphite looks like chicken wire, for a pattern of carbons, and the only difference is that it's just one layer of it. Okay, that's what graphene is. And the way they prepared it was by putting a piece of tape on graphite and pulling it off, and one layer peeled off sometimes. But it has very interesting properties. That's what it looks like they did scanning probe microscopy on it. You won't be surprised to hear. One thing they used scanning probe microscopy for was to see how hard you had to push on it in order to break it. And it turns out to be very hard. It's tougher than steel on the basis of weight. But the most interest in it is its electronic properties. It may replace silicon, they think, sometime in computers. But of course, it's this unique molecular orbital structure that has to do with all these p orbitals in a lattice parallel to one another that give it these unique electrical and optical properties, also stability and strength, and of course resonance is a factor here. So this is the kind of stuff we're talking about now with respect to orbitals. And the AFM picture, or the probably a scanning tunneling microscopy picture, is one that would be familiar to you. Actually, Geim got into this, perhaps, I'm not actually sure how he got into it, but it may have been from other work that he did. You remember this thing I passed around earlier in this semester, the thing that seems to disobey Earnshaw's theorem because it levitates. There's an energy minimum for that little magnet there. And the reason, which we didn't go into in class, is that those two little black things above and below are graphene. In fact, there are multiple layers of graphene. It's graphite. And there's something funny about the quantum mechanics of graphene, in fact, of any material, that mean that when a magnet comes up, it repels it, but only very weakly. That's called diamagnetism. And we don't have time now either to go through in detail how that works. It doesn't take too long to explain, but we won't do it now. But Geim was working on this kind of what's called diamagnetic levitation 10 years ago. And conceivably, the fact that graphite played an important role in that heightened his interest in graphene. Which actually, they only started studying it in 2004 or something like that. This is a fairly early Nobel Prize. But in fact, I got this machine from Martin Simon in the physics department at UCLA, and he put me in touch with Geim at that time, who was doing these experiments, and Geim sent me this picture of the levitation of a magnet with Geim's hand. So that's the hand of the physics Nobel laureate this year. So his finger and thumb are substituting for graphene. Almost everything is diamagnetic. Everything is, to a certain extent, diamagnetic. Okay, but he's better known in this levitation world not for levitating a magnet with his fingers, but for levitating a diamagnet. And this is his picture of levitating a frog. You may have seen this. Okay, so this, but this isn't what he got the Nobel Prize for. Okay, but this morning early, the Nobel Prize in Chemistry was announced, and it went to Richard Heck, Eiichi Nagishi, and Akira Suzuki for palladium-catalyzed cross-couplings in organic synthesis. So all synthetic chemists cheer for this because this is real hardcore synthetic methods development, developing new reactions to do very subtle things and to do them very effectively. We need to do a little bit more today. I have some a little bit later in the talk to talk about what they do, but we have to do other things first, because what's involved in this is exactly what we're talking about now. And Suzuki, in fact, as you'll see, uses boron in his cross-coupling reactions to make carbon-carbon bonds. So it's entirely appropriate that we're talking about bonding in boron now. And this is where we were last time, remember, talking about BH3. I had no idea that that was what the Nobel Prize was going to be. So the motivation for doing this is to see to what extent and why we are justified in talking about bonds between pairs of atoms, when we know that the Schrödinger equation applies to the system as a whole and these waves go all over everything and so on. How can it be that we can talk about how things behave just in terms of these nearest neighbors? So we're talking about three different ways of looking at BH3. The first way is to look at it from the point of view of the molecule itself in terms of the total electron density, which is what's real and what's measurable. You can measure it with X-ray. The second is from the point of view of the molecular orbitals that a computer generates in order to try to understand how nature works. And the third is making bonds from hybrid atomic orbitals, which is how a chemist approaches the same problem. And what you want to see is to what extent these things are the same, so that we're justified in talking about bonds and hybridization and so on. So we did this last time, but we did it very quickly at the end, and I got better pictures now, so I'll show it to you again. First, what the molecule looks like. It cares nothing about molecular orbitals, which aren't real anyhow. It cares nothing about bonds and orbital hybridization. But what it does care about is the total electron density. So here's planar BH3 turned at an angle so we can see things a little better. And it was calculated with a laptop program called Spartan using... This describes the basis set that was used. You remember we mentioned last time what a basis set is. Do you remember? You can't possibly use all possible atomic orbitals to put together into the molecular orbitals to make the best possible description of what what orbitals look like, right? So you have to limit yourself to certain number of orbitals and certain shapes, and that describes what particular set was used. It's a reasonably good, modest set. Okay, so then we can look at the computed total electron density at different contours. If we look at fairly high electron density, therefore close to the nuclei, what we see is it's big on boron. Why? Because that's the 1s electrons of boron, very, very low in energy compared to any place else to be. So that's the core orbitals of boron. But if we go to a slightly lower, half the electron density, move out a little bit, now we see the hydrogens beginning to participate in where the electrons are. And if we go a little bit lower to 0.05 electrons per cubic AU, AU is that A sub zero is the Bohr radius. That's the units that people who do calculations often measure distance in. Okay, that's in fact last time I said angstroms, A capital A with a little zero over. It's not. It's actually small a with a little zero under. So it's not angstroms. It's Bohr radii. But at any rate, and in this one we see a little dimple in the middle. That's because we're getting away from the core electrons now. And we're seeing the valence electrons. And the valence electrons would rather be on hydrogen than on boron, because hydrogen is, well, let us say, more electronegative. We'll talk about that a little more later. But at any rate, the hydrogen orbital is lower in energy somewhat than the boron orbital. So the best combination of the two is more on hydrogen than on boron. And we see that kind of thing here, that the electrons are more on hydrogen than they are on boron. If we go to a still smaller density, then we see much the same thing. And if we go to 0.002 electrons per cubic Bohr radius, then these spheres on the hydrogens are beginning to meld. We hardly see the dimple anymore. And in fact, This is the shape of the molecule. That's the van der Waals surface, the surface where you have 0.002 electrons per cubic Bohr radius is actually, for purposes of this program and many others, defined as what the van der Waals surface is. That's about how close molecules come to one another in crystals. So that 0.002 is relevant from that point of view. I mean, there's nothing absolute about that, and molecules get a little closer and obviously can get further apart as well, but that's often used as matching how close things tend to get in crystals. So that's the van der Waals surface, and we can plot on the van der Waals surface how much energy a proton would have if we're at different points on the van der Waals surface. And we talked about that before. And we color it according to the energy, and that's called the electrostatic potential. So it's the energy of a positive probe on the surface, on the van der Waals surface of a molecule. So you can see that some places where it's red, the positive charge is happy, and where it's blue, the positive charge is unhappy because it's positively charged. So the H's are here, here, and here are mostly negative, right? So a proton likes to be near them, and near the boron in the middle, if it gets near there, it's high in energy. In fact, you can calculate what those energies are that get color-coded here. The highest energy is plus 55 kilocalories per mole if you're right next to the boron, but if you're here between two hydrogens, then that's the lowest energy, minus 7.5, and you can see that as you go around the periphery here, the energy is favorable all the time for a proton, but up on top you're nearer the boron, and then it's higher in energy. Okay, so that's what the molecule sees, is total electron density. That's all the molecule cares about. But if you're a computer, then you divide the total electron density into molecular orbitals and say there are two electrons at each of the occupied molecular orbitals, none in the other molecular orbitals, and then if you sum all those together, you get the total density, which is what's real and typically measurable, right? But the computer divides it up that way. Okay, so the computer partitions total electron density into delocalized molecular orbitals that go over the whole thing. And of course, we've seen this before. They're the same kind of waves that you saw in the Chladni in two dimensions, or these plum pudding things that we talked about before. Okay, so let's look at the molecular orbitals of BH3. First, what basis set do we have? The smallest reasonable basis set is to say we have on the boron a 1s orbital, 2s, and 3 2p orbitals. Those are the valence orbitals. And for hydrogen, each of the three hydrogens, we have a 1s. So if that's our basis set that we use, I mean, you could put, 2s, 2p, 3s, 3d, 3d orbitals in there, and you'd allow the orbitals to change their shape a little bit to get even better. But it doesn't change it very much, so for crude purposes, it's not worth it, right? Because it makes it a much more complicated calculation. So anyhow, with this minimal basis set, how many independent molecular orbitals can we construct? Well, we're starting with 8 atomic orbitals from which we're going to make molecular orbitals. So we'll be able to make 8 molecular orbitals. If we used more atomic orbitals, we could make more independent molecular orbitals, but we don't need to do that for qualitative purposes. Okay, so we'll stick with just this simple picture of using 8 atomic orbitals in the basis set to construct 8 low-energy molecular orbitals, and that turns out to be the energies of these molecular orbitals schematically. Okay, now, what are these molecular orbitals? What do you think the very lowest molecular orbital is, the lowest energy electron pair of BH3? Where will it be? Ashvin? Where is the very best place to be? Yeah, right. The boron has by far the biggest nuclear charge. There are no electrons in there yet, right? So it's going to be a 1s orbital. It's going to have the shape of a 1s orbital. It's going to be down near the boron. So we have 8 electron pairs eight electrons, four pairs that come from five on boron and one on each of the three hydrogens. So four of these orbitals, these four are going to be occupied. And as Ashwin tells us, those orbitals will be occupied molecular orbitals, OMOs, and the other four that we can get from this basis set will be unoccupied molecular orbitals, obviously, UMOs. Okay, now, further, a little more on nomenclature. The highest energy occupied orbitals are called HOMOs. Typically, there's only one HOMO. In this case, there happen to be two that have the same energy. Okay, and that one there is called the LUMO, the lowest unoccupied. So the highest occupied and the lowest unoccupied, you'll see, are very important. We'll get to that later in the lecture. Those are the ones that have, to a first approximation, determine what chemistry, what reactions will occur. Okay, so now, the first one is 1s on boron, and that's what Ashwin told us, and that's fine. Now, the next one is going to be something like 2s or 2p, right? So that one is indeed 2s. And we can see that it's 2s by making it into a net instead of a solid and seeing that little radial node down inside. Right, so it's clearly a 2s orbital. And now there are two that have equal energies, and it doesn't surprise you at all that those are 2p orbitals. There's this 2p orbital, 2px, and it's drawn out by those hydrogens below, as we've seen before. And there's the 2py orbital. Those are the same in energy. Okay, so they're two HOMOs. Okay, but then the 2pz is unoccupied because it's still higher in energy. Why is the 2pz higher in energy than the 2px and the 2py? Christina?
It's just because specifically in this.
Speak up, please. The node, pardon me, the node in any of these p orbitals goes through the boron. But it's not near the hydrogens, where the others have it near the hydrogens. So that's why this one's higher than the others. Okay, and then we have 3s, which has a spherical sort of node. And then 3d x squared minus y squared. And 3d xy. Okay, so that's the way a computer handles the problem. It divides what's real, the total electron density, into these four parts. And if we had to put other electrons in, we'd start using the other orbitals. Okay. So now, how about when we look at it with hybridized atomic orbitals and bonds? What do we see as chemists? We partition exactly the same total electron density into atom pair bonds, sometimes anti-bonds, the ones with nodes in them between atoms, and isolated atomic orbitals, or that is lone pairs, or sometimes we are interested in vacant atomic orbitals because of reactivities, you'll see. That's what Lewis talks about. Okay, so we usually do that, and usually it works pretty well. But sometimes it doesn't. So when this doesn't work, we have to use more sophisticated orbitals, not just these pairwise things of bonds or isolated unshared pairs. We have to use, when we have to use these more sophisticated orbitals, we say there is a certain phenomenon going on. What's the phenomenon? When you can't just draw bonds and understand things. Resonance. Right? That's what resonance is, when this scheme has to be cobbled together and you say the structure is intermediate between two of these things. Okay, and we'll understand more about that late in the lecture. Okay, so here's what the computer saw, right? Now, what do we see when, as chemists, we look at it? Well, we still say there's a boron core, the 1s electrons on boron, that we don't differ on. But when it comes to the other orbitals, we divide it. Remember, that's localized mostly on the boron, right? You don't care about other things, so it's reasonable that we agree because the computer says it's localized and we say it's localized, right? But for these others, we say it's pairs, not delocalized over the whole thing. So we look at a some sort of hybridized boron orbital, some sp hybrid, overlapping with a hydrogen orbital. Why do they make it bigger on hydrogen than on BH? This bonding orbital. Yeah. More spread out where? Is it more on hydrogen or more on boron? Why more on hydrogen? Now, if it had a smaller nuclear charge, which it does, but if that's all there was to it, the electron would rather be near boron than be near hydrogen. Right? So you'd expect it to be the other way if it were just nuclear charge. Right? And in fact, these electrons are on boron only, not on hydrogen, because of the high nuclear charge of boron. But now that these two are here, we've already decreased the effective nuclear charge, like Z effective of boron, so it's not so dramatic. Plus, in the case of boron, we're dealing with 2s orbitals for the valence orbital. With hydrogen, it's 1s. So you have to consider not only the nuclear charge, but also which n value, whether it's 1s, 2s, 3s, and so on. And that's, of course, the basis of the periodic table. As you go across a row in the periodic table, you increase the nuclear charge but keep the same n. But when you go down to the next row, then you go up higher in n. So even though you have a higher nuclear charge in rubidium than you do in krypton, this one is less electronegative, higher nuclear charge, but it's the next n. Okay, so hydrogen gets the lion's share of these electrons because it's a 1s rather than a 2s orbital. Okay? So that is, so we say then that there's this kind of bond, right? But there are three of them, right? All we say have the same energy, right? But it turns out that the sum of the energies of these six electrons is the same as the sum of the energy of those six electrons. So if we're interested in the total energy, we do just as well as the computer in qualitative terms. Okay, so we get the same energy. Okay. And furthermore, if you sum all these electron densities together, you get the same total, and the core, of course, you get the same total electron density that the computer got. So for what's real, the total energy and the total electron density, the two pictures are the same. So they're just different ways of dividing up the total electron density pi. Right? And granted, the computer's way of doing it is much more quantitative. You can calculate it to many decimal points, whereas this idea is just qualitative, right? But still, for qualitative purposes, it's fine to do it to divide the pi this way rather than in terms of these plum pudding orbitals. Okay, then we have antibonding orbitals that are now big on boron and small on hydrogen. For this, because you used up most of the hydrogen here, you don't have much left here. You didn't use up much of the boron, you have plenty left here. So these are bigger on boron than on hydrogen, these star, the antibonding orbitals. And those three have the same energy as the three vacant orbitals in sum, the same as the vacant orbitals of the molecular orbital picture. So for many purposes, localized bond orbitals are not so bad. Okay? And they're certainly much easier to think about. But you have to beware that sometimes resonance will be important, and we can't think about this. We can't do it this easily, and we have to be able to recognize when it's going to be important. Okay. And furthermore, this isn't such a good way if you're interested not in the total energy and the total density, but the position or energy of an individual electron. Then you have to go to the computer kind of things. For example, if you were interested in how much energy it takes to pull an electron out of a molecule, you get a different prediction if you pull out one from the molecular orbital picture than if you pull one out from the bonding picture. Okay? Or if you're interested in what color of light will be absorbed, the lowest energy light that can be absorbed. In the computer picture, you can go from here to here, You could go from here to here, but in the bond picture, you would go from here to here, so it would be different energies. So if you're interested in one electron properties, it's not so good. But if you're interested in just getting the total electron density, the total energy, the shape of the molecule, and so on, then it's not bad to talk about bonds. So it's not surprising that the idea of bonds developed as a practical way of doing things, and we'll talk about that when we finish with quantum mechanics, how the idea of bonding developed. Okay, so the localized bond orbital picture, pairwise bond orbitals, just two atoms, and isolated atomic orbitals in some cases, is our intermediate between hydrogen-like AOs, which we understand very well, and the computer's complicated molecular orbitals. Okay. But when do we have to think more deeply? When we care about individual electrons, what I just said, for ionization or visible ultraviolet light absorption, or when mixing of localized orbitals causes reactivity or resonance, and that's what we're going to be talking about real soon. So where are we in this? We looked at atoms, at H-like atom wave functions, at hybridization to shift the electrons around, of orbitals for many electron atoms, which are fundamentally wrong, but we can recover to a certain extent by using self-consistent field or these complicated other techniques like configuration interaction. Then we went on to molecules, with many nuclei. We looked at plum pudding ones, where you treat molecules as if they were atoms with the nucleus split up a little bit. We tried to understand bonds in terms of pairwise linear combination of atomic orbitals to make where they come together, one goes down, they go down and up. And if you have two electrons, that's great, they'll both go down. If you have four electrons, they go up a little more than down, that kind of thing. We talked about energy match and overlap, that overlap is what makes them split, but if the energies are mismatched, you don't get as much effect out of the overlap. We talked about checking this with structure and dynamics experimental spectroscopy of XH3 molecules, and we've just been talking about parsing the electron density into, with a computer, breaking the total electron density into orbitals, with our thinking breaking it into localized bonds and unshared pairs. Okay, now where are we going? We're going now to reactivity. So we'll be interested in singly occupied molecular orbitals, in highest occupied molecular orbitals, and lowest vacant molecular orbitals, lowest unoccupied. Now, it seems at first glance redundant to say high HOMOs and low LUMOs, but just because something is highest doesn't necessarily mean it's high, right? What's it a question of? Right, compared to what? Okay, so we're interested in high HOMOs and low LUMOs. Okay, and when we get to this, we'll be able to recognize functional groups and tell how they will react and what they'll react with, and that's the payoff for organic chemistry. Okay, now, so when molecules come together, each of the two molecules has occupied orbitals and vacant orbitals. So a molecule B, say, will have a bunch of orbitals and a certain number of electrons. So some of the lowest orbitals will be occupied and the rest will be vacant. How many will there be going on up? Infinite number. Okay. Okay, and molecule A will have the same. Okay. And now we talked about pairwise mixing orbitals, atomic orbitals. They come together and go like this. But orbitals are orbitals. They're one electron wave functions. We could take two molecular orbitals and bring them together and mix them too. And if we form a bond, that would be a reaction between the two molecules. Okay? So we can bring an orbital from this molecule, an orbital from this molecule together. They'll mix, see what happens. What determines how much they go up and down when you bring two molecular orbitals together from different molecules? How much overlap there is, and what else? How well their energies match. Okay, so now but we got a problem because we got two infinite numbers of orbitals, and we're going to bring them together, so we have something like infinite squared number of possible interactions. This sounds like difficulties. Okay? So let's just think about which ones we have to worry about mixing. Okay, so for example, it might be we might have to worry about those two mixing when they come together. Or those two, 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 those two, those two, and so on. Right? There are myriad possible pairwise mixings. Fortunately, very few of them are relevant. So we have to recognize which ones are relevant. Okay, so let's first take the special case that there are orbitals in each of these which have a single electron in it. If those come together and they overlap, so singly occupied molecular orbitals, if those come together and overlap, both electrons will go down in energy and that'll be a new bond. So that's going to really be favorable. So clearly, if there are singly occupied molecular orbitals, that's going to be really important as long as they can overlap. Okay, so SOMO-SOMO interaction, when they exist, when SOMOs are there, is certainly important for reactivity. Right? Now, that applies for many atoms, like hydrogen atom, chlorine atom, for example, and also for things called free radicals, which have odd electrons, like CH3 with a single electron on it, not involved in a bond. So when those things come together, they very easily form a new bond. So that's very reactive to be that. Now, however, they're relatively, if you live on the sun, that's really important, right? But if you live on the Earth, well, it's still important, but not very many reactions. I mean, it's very important for things like respiration and OH radicals that are important, thought to be important in aging and cancer and stuff like that. But these are not the most reactions. Why? Because in order for these things to be there, these things that have a singly occupied molecular orbital, in order for them to be there, they must be kept from overlapping with other ones. Right? Because if they can get together with another one, they're gone. So you can't have a bottle of them. Right? Because they'll just react in pairs. So you rarely see free radicals, even though because, in fact, they're very reactive. Okay? So, but anyhow, SOMOs with SOMOs are certainly important mixings. Okay? But most of the chemical reactions we talk about don't involve SOMOs for this obvious reason, that most of the reagents we have don't involve SOMOs. Okay, so now, how about those two mixing? Is that going to be important? Will the energy go down when these two things come together if those two orbitals mix? The energy of what? What energies go down when you do this kind of thing? The energy of electrons. So is that mixing important? Why not? There are no electrons. So all those empty ones mixing with each other, we don't care about. That's a big advantage, right? Okay, so now we're not dealing with an infinite number of things anymore. Okay, so there's nothing there. Forget it. Okay, now, how about mixing two occupied orbitals? Now there are electrons that are changing their energy. Is this going to be important? What? Yeah, there's both bonding and antibonding. And we know that to a first approximation, they cancel, so we wouldn't care at all. To a second approximation, it's slightly, because they shifted up, it's slightly unfavorable. So this is what keeps things apart. This is why molecules bounce off one another. Okay? So that's not important for bonding. It's just important for repulsion between things when they get too close. So because there are four electrons when you mix two filled orbitals, you get a weak net repulsion. So that's not going to be important for reactivity unless it keeps other things from getting together. That's in fact how you can get a bottle that has free radicals in it. If you have an atom there that has an odd electron on it, that if it could overlap with something else would certainly react to SOMOs. But you put a lot of other stuff around it that so that when these two things come together, those other things repel one another before these two can get together. then you can have a bottle of radicals. Okay, but they're not very reactive, at least not with each other. Okay, so we don't have to worry about those. Now things are really getting much simpler. Okay, so that's what defines van der Waals contact. Remember, correlation energy, helium atoms, for example, tends to bring things together. But this overlap of filled orbitals, when they begin to overlap, pushes them apart. So when they get just to the right distance, the energy is minimum. That's the van der Waals distance. Okay. Now, so that's not important for our purposes, for bonding, for reaction. Okay, now, how about those two? Now we're mixing a filled with a vacant orbital, right? So is that going to be really important? Is there any reason it might not be so important as other things might be? Aisha? Right. Right. The energy difference between this starting orbital and this one is very, very big. They're very mismatched in their energy. So the best combination of this one with this one looks essentially like this one and only goes down a teeny bit in energy. You put very little of this one in this one to get the best combination. So you don't get enough out of that. You don't form enough bond for it to make much difference. Okay? So we don't care about that one. Is there anything we care about? Okay. That one is negligible mixing and stabilization because of bad energy match. But that one is the best possible, right? Because these two are close enough in energy that you get a significant shift of just two electrons going down. So that's the one you really care about, right? You don't care so much about this one with this one. Notice that that's the highest occupied molecular orbital on the right. And this is the lowest unoccupied molecular orbital on the left, but still it's not very important because they're not sufficiently high and low. But this one, the highest one on the left, is unusually high, and this one is unusually low, and now they're close enough together that you get something and would get a reaction. So you can see what's coming. All we have to be able to do is look at a molecule and see whether a molecule is going to have an unusually high occupied orbital or an unusually low molecular or low vacant orbital, and then we'll know whether it's reactive and what it will react with. A high HOMO reacts with a low LUMO and vice versa. Okay? So that gives rise to bonding. So what we need for reactivity, which MO is mixing matters for reactivity, certainly singly occupied with singly occupied, SOMO with SOMO. But more generally, unusually high HOMO with an unusually low LUMO. Now, if all the time we had to talk about something being reactive, we had to say unusually high HOMO, that would inhibit conversation, right? So we need a short way of saying it. You know what you say about a molecule that has an unusually high HOMO, what you call it? A base. And you know what you call something with an unusually low LUMO? An acid. So now we're going to look at these examples of this. So most mixing of MOs affects neither the overall energy nor the overall electron distribution for one of more or more of these reasons. The electron occupancy is zero. There's nothing to have a change in energy. Or four, so that two go down and two go up. You have poor energy match, right? So you don't get much mixing altogether. Or you have poor overlap, like the fact that these two singly occupied molecular orbitals, which should really do the trick, if they're kept apart by other things, then they can't react. We'll see other examples of poor overlap too. But mixing of high HOMO and low LUMO constitutes reactivity, unusually high and unusually low. So acid-base theories. We'll look at the evolution of acid-base theories. And like most scientific things, the evolution is an increasing sophistication. It always gives you greater generality So you'll see that. So the idea originated with Lavoisier in 1789, and we'll talk about that, where an acid was something that had been oxidized, and a base was something that was ready to be oxidized. And we'll talk about how he developed the names acid and base. Then, 100 years later, Arrhenius came along, and he said an acid was something that could give rise to H+. Arrhenius was the guy who had the idea that you could have ions when you dissolved something in solution. And things that gave, he said, that gave H+ ions were acids. Okay, so an H+ source was an acid, and an OH- source was a base. And 30 years later, Brunstad and Lowry developed the idea that an acid is an H+ donor, same as Arrhenius, but they were more general about what the base was, not just OH- to accept the proton, but other things that could accept a proton. So an H+ acceptor was a base, according to them. So this is, as you see, increasing generality. And then Lewis, also in 1923, said that an acid was something that was an electron pair acceptor, which came to be called electrophile. I mean, H+ is certainly something that's capable of stabilizing electrons, of accepting electrons, right? So, but there could be other things that would do that, that would be electrophiles. So that's a generalization. And by the same token, a base was something that was an electron pair donor. So remember, we talked about how NH3, the unshared pair for Lewis, made that into a base, or a nucleophile, something that's looking for nuclei to stabilize its electrons, right? And then, say, 30 or 40 years later, came the homo-lumo concepts that we're talking about now. So that an acid is an unusually low lumo, which is certainly something that's an electron pair acceptor. It's someplace that's good to put electrons. And an electron pair donor is something that's an unusually high occupied orbital. Okay, and remember that these have to be unusual in compared to just every molecule has a highest homo and a lowest lumo, right? But not all of them are acids and bases. They have to be unusual in their highness or lowness. Okay, so now unusual raises the question that we just raised a minute ago. Compared to what? Okay? And what we compare to is the things that you have in normal hydrocarbon kind of things. So things made of carbon and hydrogen. So carbon and hydrogen orbitals, the sp3 of carbon and the 1s orbital of hydrogen, are about the same energy. This is just a qualitative picture here. They're about the same energy, and they come together and they overlap and they make a bond. And the bigger overlap, the more down and the more up. But this is sort of standard CH bonds. Okay, so this is the normal energy of HOMOs for our purposes, and that's the normal energy of a LUMO, because all molecules, organic molecules, have that. Okay, so those are usual LUMO and usual HOMO, right? And if this had been carbon here, it would have been about the same. This amount of overlap is about the same. So those are the energies of normal HOMOs and LUMOs, right? So if you get weird molecules, so unusual ones, then they're going to be reactive as acids or bases. Okay, now what are the sources of this weirdness? You can have valence shell AOs, so in this area, right, which didn't overlap with anything. So they don't go up and down. So if they have electrons, they're unusually high. If they don't have electrons, they're unusually low. You can have some overlap, but not this much overlap, so that the high ones would be unusually high, the low ones unusually low. Okay? You can have unusual atomic orbital energies going into making the molecular orbital. So instead of using carbon and hydrogen, you could use something that was up here, in which case, obviously, you're going to get higher energies, or something that's down here, in which case you're going to get lower energies. Or you can have electric charge. Obviously, if you have negative charge around, it's not good to put electrons there, so the orbitals are going to be high in energy. If you have positive charge around, that's a good place to put electrons, low in energy. So those are the four things you look for to see if something might be unusually high and low, therefore unusually reactive as an acid or base. So let's look at some examples. First, unmixed valence shell atomic orbitals, so where they weren't involved in bondings. For example, H+, right, wasn't involved in making a bond, no electrons. It's this orbital, it's unusually low, right? So it's going to be an acid or a base? H plus acid, right? It's a good place to put electrons. That's what we call. So that's an unusually low LUMO. Or if we have NH3. Now, these electrons are on nitrogen. We looked at that orbital before, the unshared pair on nitrogen. Now, nitrogen has a bigger nuclear charge, obviously, than carbon does. That makes its electrons low in energy, right? So how could we say that that's an unusually high HOMO if the electrons are on nitrogen? That seems backwards. Yeah. But they didn't mix. They started low, like these, lower than these, but they didn't go up and down because they're not mixed with anything. So they're unusually high because they are an unmixed atomic orbital, even though they started low. How about BH3? That's just the mirror image of this. It's an unusually low compared to this vacant orbital. Boron doesn't have such a big nuclear charge, so you'd expect its orbitals to be high. Why is it unusually low? Because it's not mixed. It didn't go up the way these did and down. Okay. So this is an acid. This is an acid. This is a base. Okay? Or look at H2O, right? Unshared pair. Even more of a nuclear charge, so lower than the NH3, but higher than a CH bond. So unusually high, HOMO, the unshared pair. So you can protonate H2O and make H3O+. Right? Or even better for oxygen is OH-. At first glance, it's the same unshared pair. They're both the unshared pairs are on oxygen. Right? Why is that one unusually high? I mean, unusually higher than this one. Because of the negative charge. Okay? Okay. CH3-, even higher. So that's going to be a very, very strong base. Okay? So these H+, OH-, CH3-, these are all especially bad, or especially unusual, because of the electric charge that's involved. This one unusually low, these unusually high. Okay, and this, because of this, you can get acid-base reactions between these. So for example, OH-, we said, was a base, H+ is an acid, so those electrons could be stabilized by the orbital on H+, to give water, right? And notice the curved arrow designates the electron pair shift from on OH to between O and H. It's not the atomic motion that the curved arrow is showing. It's how the electrons are shifting. So you start the arrow where they are in the starting material, that pair, and you end it where they end, between H and O, to make that new bond. Okay, but not only that, NH3 we said was a base as well as OH-. So the same curved arrow, and again you can form a bond. Notice now it's N+, because for bookkeeping purposes, the nitrogen lost half interest in that pair of electrons when it shared them. When you have tetravalent nitrogen, it's always plus. By the same token, you can have OH- react with BH3, and now you have a tetravalent boron, which is always minus for the same kind of reason. Or you can have NH3 react with BH3 and get that thing that has both a bookkeeping plus and a bookkeeping minus. Okay, now the second reason is poor overlap of the molecular orbitals. Now, this one's real fast, so I can do it in the remaining minute and a half. So you get poorer overlap with p orbitals side by side. We looked at that already, right? So these started essentially the same place, although a little bit higher because they were p rather than sp cubed, right? So that they started essentially the same place, but they didn't go up and down as much because they didn't have such good overlap. So now that's an unusually high HOMO. This is an unusually low LUMO also, but not as unusual because these started a little higher. So much of the reactivity of C-C double bond will be because of this high HOMO, although sometimes because of the low LUMO also. But typically the high HOMO is what we think about, right? Or if you have a C double bond O, it started lower here with the oxygen and ended lower. So is that as unusually high as this one? No, so that's not what makes C double bond O reactive. What makes C double bond O reactive is this one, unusually low LUMO, right? So that's going to be an acid, not a base. Okay. Or another case of bad overlap is the one we saw there when bonds were bent. So those bonds are going to be reactive too because they had very little overlap. They didn't go far up and down. Now, unfortunately, I'm going to quit now, but tomorrow night, I have some about the Nobel Prize in here, but it comes after this slide, so we'll have to, you won't get it quite so hot off the press as it would have been now.
The class tomorrow night is at the section.